I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword No. 2, Interlude at the Hotel Monolith in C-sharp minor by Benjamin D. Hutchins. That would be me. Thursday, December 29th, 2405, 5:21 p.m., Room 212-41, Imperial Hotel Monolith, New Avalon, Zeta Cygni. The golden and scarlet lights of New Avalon twinkled and glittered through the great panoramic windows of Room 212-41. From this side of the building, a person standing at those windows could see the entire State Building's Gothic spire, the southeast corner of the Aztechnology Pyramid, Knight's Field, the Battledrome, Morgan Arena, and about half of the grid of broad downtown streets. In the distance, the lights of Matthews Memorial Spaceport could be seen, and their reflections in the lake. The golden glow suffused the room, giving it a feeling of warmth even with the room lights on. Utena Tenjo stood at that window, looking out at that view, smiling thoughtfully. Behind her, through the open connecting doors to the adjacent room, she could hear Corwin Ravenhair bustling around, sorting out shopping bags and luggage, and generally doing the kinds of things a person does when taking temporary possession of a hotel room. She waited until he was done with all that and had put his head through the connecting doorway, then turned and smiled at him. "You were right," she said. "The view is spectacular from up here. Better than from the entire State Building." Corwin grinned. "It's the sight lines. The monolith has the best location in town." He glanced at his watch. "You ready? We've got just time for dinner before the game." "Sure." Ever the gentleman, he held Utena's coat for her as she shrugged into it, and as they left the room, she took his arm, smiling. They'd been together all day, having left Corwin's father's house on Morgan Lane that morning for a day of shopping and video gaming at the Avalon Center Galleria, followed by a session in the simulators at the Battledrome. Now they were bound for dinner at Yahagi's, the sphere's finest Italian restaurant, and then a Razors game at Morgan Arena, before spending the night, just for the sheer hell of it, in adjoining rooms on the 212th floor of the Imperial Monolith, arguably the galaxy's finest hotel. As programs went, Utena reflected as Corwin guided his antique Griffin limousine toward the restaurant, it would have made a fine date, if they were dating. But, of course they weren't. Hadn't been, in fact, for a little over 9 months. The notion would have struck them both as quite absurd. Clearly such a thing was impossible. Utena was far from available, being engaged to be married to a girl with whom she found herself quite irretrievably in love. And at any rate, Corwin, being a year and a half her junior, was much too young for her. Of course, the girl in question was on the other side of a gap that appeared unbridgeable, and Corwin, the son of an immortal hero and a goddess, was hardly an ordinary 14-year-old, but still, don't be ridiculous. He was handsome and honest, strong and kind, an altogether wonderful friend to have, but that's all he was. And he might well think that Utena Tenjo was the most beautiful girl he had, was ever likely to encounter in his life, and very probably the most admirable as well, but that didn't automatically make his intentions dishonorable. She'd told him months ago that it couldn't be, and he'd prized her friendship above all his other possessions. After all, her loyalty was one of the things about her that he loved. How hypocritical would it have been of him to turn around and con her into dating him? No mistaking, though, Utena liked being with Corwin. She'd learned that fairly early on in their friendship. He was the only guy she knew who could really make her feel, well, like a girl, without at the same time making her feel mockingly patronized or greedily coveted. He had a sort of old-fashioned gallantry about him which yet accommodated her own quirks. No, more than that, reveled in them. He accepted, welcomed, her for what she was, sharp edges, occasionally unwise bluntness, rough-and-tumble tomboyishness and all. She liked his ability to hold doors for her without making her feel as if he considered her too helpless to open a door for herself. He liked her ability to laugh out loud, head thrown back, without any of that silly, mouth-covering giggling that modern girls thought was seemly. They made a good team. Over the course of the year they'd known each other now, each had learned a lot from the other, and enjoyed almost every minute of it. As they had almost every Friday for the past 3 school terms, and more often during the holidays, They ate dinner together, talked, laughed, enjoyed each other's company, and reflected how lucky they were that they didn't have to do all this in the grim and constraining structure of a relationship. What a dire thing that would be. Yes, indeed. The Razors and the Detroit Red Wings took a one-all thriller almost all the way through sudden death overtime before newly traded Razors goaltender René-Philippe Target, poor Roy Chernow. Utunen and Sionji had received a mock heartbroken little note from him when Target was traded, telling them, as Avalonians, to take good care of the goalie. Saved his team with an absolutely heart-stopping glove save, then belted the clearing pass straight into an utterly gorgeous two-on-one cross-ice setup that allowed Mike Guerrick to blast home the winning goal with 7 seconds left on the clock. Utunen and Corwin cheered, slammed a high five, and counted themselves lucky to have the kind of buddy you could go to a hockey game with on a Thursday night. Still riding the high from the game, they went back to the Monolith, stowed the Griffin, and rode the elevator back to the 212th floor. "I'm too wired to sleep," Utunen announced as they entered room 212-41. "And anyway, it's still too early. Not even 10 yet." "We could go to a movie," Corwin said, "or bowling or something." "Nah," said Utunen. "I'd rather stay in, have some quiet time. We've been around other people all day. Why don't you call for that cheese platter from room service and we'll see what's on TV?" This he did, then sat in one of the room's comfortable armchairs, munching cheeses from around the galaxy and an assortment of very special crackers, while Utunen did random stretching exercises, some of them very interesting indeed, and surfed the channels for something watchable. They talked about this, that, and nothing at all during the dull parts of the dial, laughed uproariously at the 10:30 episode of Iron Chef, featuring Corwin's Aunt Belle as Iron Chef Tomodachi, warned the hapless teenagers in about 10 minutes' worth of some horrible slasher flick not to go through those doors, and caught the last 3 innings of Game 7 of the 2404 World Series on the Classic Sports Channel. "Oh my God, they put that on TV?" Utunen burst out as, there on the Toronto Raiderdome Jumbotron during the 7th-inning stretch, her very own effort, languorous and luxurious, was immortalized for all time. "Looks that way," said Corwin with a grin. "Not bad, not bad at all. And I've been watching you stretch all night." She gave him a return grin and insisted, "It's important to stay limber," before starting on a series of standing hamstring stretches. As she did so, Utunen wondered idly while she was starting to feel a little nervous. It didn't make any damn sense. She was having a wonderful day in the company of one of her favorite individuals. There was no reason for her to feel edgy, and yet, just on the fringes of her consciousness, it was like there was an alarm bell ringing. Maybe it was the mental inactivity of watching TV. "Hey," she said, flicking off the set. "Let's play a game." "Okay," said Corwin, and he got up and went to the little table near the windows. They played not one, but several games, losing small amounts of money to each other at several card games before breaking out the Pente set Corwin had bought for her earlier in the day, then switching that out for a game of lying bastard Scrabble. This, Utunen managed to win with Mixtagogic. It means of or pertaining to the teaching of the mixological arts. By now it was 1 a.m. Yawning a little, Utunen went to brush her teeth and change into her pajamas. Corwin did the same in 212-43, then came back to say goodnight. "What, you're going to bed already?" Utunen asked him. "Don't be a piker, it's only 1. Now this, Utunen noted to herself, was just damn peculiar. She sounded like a frightened child trying to be brave, asking him to stay as though she were suddenly afraid of being left alone. What the hell was the matter with her tonight? Shaking her head, irritated with herself, she climbed up onto the bed, arranged the pillows against the headboard, then propped herself up a bit to one side of center and patted the coverlet next to her. "Come on, let's see what's on the late movie." Corwin did not need to have his arm twisted. In an hour, the lights were out and the two sat, leaning comfortably against each other, Corwin's arm snug and warm around Utunen's shoulders. They were illuminated by the grayish flicker of the TV as they watched a heavily dramatized movie purporting to depict the founding of the Wedge Defense Force and its first altercation with Genom Corporation. "Corwin," said Utunen softly. "Hmm?" Corwin replied. "I had a really good time today," she said. "Thanks." He grinned. "You're welcome," he said, and then in a slightly more serious, softer tone, he added, "Happy birthday, Utunen." Then, with what for him in this respect was a display of startling boldness, he kissed her gently on the cheek. Or at least he would have, had she not turned to say something to him at that exact moment, and inadvertently presented her slightly opened mouth instead. For a second they looked at each other across the small distance separating them, surprise in his eyes, startled realization in hers. For all that she scoffed publicly at the notion of herself and Corwin as a couple, Utna had thought about it, off and on, from a daydreamy sort of in-a-perfect-world perspective. He was handsome, strong, and rapidly maturing into a fine figure of a man, and Utna was only human. Moreover, she was a healthy human of a passionate nature, and her tastes ran, the very special case that was Anthemia notwithstanding, to men of the type he was fast growing into. As for Corwin, he'd never made any particular secret of the fact that he thought she was captivatingly beautiful. So, in addition to their mutual affection, there was a definite physical tension, and it grew with their every meeting. She knew it, he knew it, and neither denied it. Deny that they could be in capital L love, yes. Deny that invisible energy, no. It would have been like denying the moon's pull on the oceans of Earth. Instead, she sublimated it, using the energy that it produced to make their slightly self-consciously non-romantic relationship stronger, knowing he did the same. Since the summer, they'd even grown comfortable enough with it to banter lightly about it as they had earlier in the evening. They eyed each other speculatively across a gap that, under normal conditions, both were conscious of, and both confident that they'd never cross. These conditions, though, weren't normal. They'd been together, alone among crowds of strangers, and how curious that that could in some ways feel more intimate than actual solitude, for the entire day. It was Utina's birthday, a time for marking one's place and reflecting. She'd been alone for more than a year. She didn't know if Anthe were alive or dead, and Utina's efforts to find a way back to her, if she were anywhere at all, had been futile. Utina couldn't admit it to herself yet, but she was starting to wonder somewhere deep down if hope could survive. And here was Corwin, her beloved friend. Yes, by God, she did love him, one way or the other. There could be no more pretending, not on that score, not now. Who never wanted anything but happiness for her. He'd been so good to her, made her feel so special. The city was so beautiful. Here, now, in this one moment of time, triggered by that accidental kiss, Utina's barriers between reality and speculative fantasy collapsed, and she was overcome. Her eyes closed, and she fell against him with a soft, aching sound. Corwin's head swam. All he'd meant to do was give her an innocent birthday kiss on the cheek. All right, and in doing so smell her hair, and savor that tiny instant of greatest nearness to her. And here she was in his arms, her hand sliding across his back, her mouth insistent on his. He'd kissed her before a couple of times, mostly in foolish, vertiginous moments that had been swept away by the times that gave rise to them as quickly as they arrived. But that was never anything like this. His constant awareness of her exploded into a sort of hypersensory phenomenon, a synthesis of all the sensations of her body against his, the heat of her nearness, the powerful, dizzying scent and taste of her. Utina's fingers raked across his chest, clawing at the buttons of his pajama top. His right hand slipped under her top, sliding across the smoothness of her back, as the fingers of his left combed through the thick hair at the back of her head. If Corwin had been thinking clearly, he might have noticed that her movements were a bit odd, a strange combination of hesitancy and haste. For a moment she paused entirely, seemed on the verge of drawing back. Then she made a harsh little noise of frustrated need and tugged at his shoulders, pulling him down upon her. And then, with a shattering suddenness like a brick through a plate glass window, everything went wrong. Utina froze, stiffening, her hands on his shoulders suddenly pushing instead of pulling. For an instant Corwin failed to notice, until she tore her mouth, gasping away from his, and cried, "Wait! Stop it! No!" Still drugged with her, his conscious mind barely ticking over, he nevertheless registered the change then. That one last syllable stopped his heart for a split second, and with instantaneous obedience like a machine, he released her, scrambling back almost as if she had suddenly burst into flames. Not quite fast enough. Her fist lashed out and smacked solidly into the corner of his jaw, knocking him clean off the end of the bed. He sprang upright, scrambling up onto the far corner again with blood in the corner of his mouth and an expression of infinite shock. Her beautiful face was twisted with a combination of fear, rage, and remorse that was so out of place on that face it stabbed him to the heart just to see it. The sight erased instantly the heat that had been boiling up within Corwin, and the confused shock that had started to overlay it, and replaced both with a cold sense of dread. Almost babbling, he said breathlessly, "What? I'm sorry. What's wrong? I didn't mean you. I..." Realizing that he was headed toward incoherence, he stopped himself with a vicious effort of will. With a deep breath, he forced himself to some semblance of composure, then said in a much calmer tone than he felt, "Utna, I'm sorry. I had no right..." "Be quiet. Be quiet!" Utna snapped. She sat rigidly upright, arms wrapped around her chest, knees drawn up and clamped together, her whole body shivering violently. It's not your fault. Not your fault. Just let me be." Confused anew, frightened himself, Corwin reached out a hand to try to comfort her. She flinched away as if from a blow, making a tiny, raw noise of terror, a spark of something ancient and ugly crossing her eyes. Stricken at the thought that something he did could ever make her react that way, he backed as far as he could get without falling to the floor again, and sat, cross-legged, waiting in an agony of indecision. He desperately wanted to apologize, to ask again what was wrong, for he was starting to get the fearful idea that whatever was happening, it wasn't all to do with what had just happened. But she'd asked to be let be, and so he would let her be. In fact, maybe he should get the hell out altogether, since it was obvious that what he'd done had caused this. But he dared not leave her completely alone. The look on her face as she stared down at the covers before her made him fear for her. And besides, he didn't want to give her the idea that he was abandoning her in a huff, because she'd stopped him doing something he shouldn't have been doing in the first place. Slowly, Utna seemed to come back to herself, her shivering slowing, then stopping, the wildness fading from her face. She ceased to sit rigid. First she slackened, then fell onto her side and curled into a ball, holding her knees against her chest. She started muttering angrily to herself. "I thought I was over that more than a year ago, for God's sake." Carefully, tentatively, Corwin eased a little closer to her. She looked up at his movement. He froze. Then slowly, her eyes crying out for gentleness, she nodded and he approached. With exquisite care, as though she were made of thin glass, he put out a hand and placed it on her shoulder. She winced a little, whimpering, but let it stay there. "I'm sorry, Corwin," she said softly, in a tone of raw and complete misery. "I shouldn't have... It's..." "Shh," he said. "I'm the one who should be sorry. I had no right to do that. I know the rules, damn me. You were right to stop me." "I... No. It's more than..." Utna shook her head. "I can't... I'll be back," she said, then got up and went into the bathroom. Corwin watched her go, listened to the shower start running. He lay back with a huge, gusty sigh, hands behind his head, berating himself. No wonder she was upset. He'd taken advantage of her. She'd been riding the glow of a great day. The lateness of the hour and pleasant memories they'd spent the day building had made her warm and sentimental, and he'd gone and kissed her. It was a bit, well, okay, a lot, gratifying that she'd reacted that way at first, but damn it all, he'd had no right to start something like that. He felt like dirt. He wondered fearfully if he had lost her friendship, her trust, by making a stupid grab at something more than what he would ever do if he had. He supposed he ought to get up, go to his own room, and try to make peace in the morning. But she'd said, "I'll be back," as though she expected him still to be here when she returned. He dabbed idly at the stinging corner of his mouth and wondered what the hell he should do.